Okay. So let's start with a reflection from Ian, and I'll share where we're going today. As a teacher of patience and tolerance, the Buddha was a failure. He did not make problems for us. He did not wish to harm us. He did not bear us any ill will. It is our enemies of the internal and external kind who provide us with the opportunity to grow in patience and tolerance. Be thankful for those who hurt us, for they placed the Dhamma before us. We just need to open our eyes. We are here to be a burden to one another. That's a whole different take on things, isn't it? That's right. It took a long time for me to really get that this human existence actually is the type of environment you need for awakening. It took a long time to see that a lot of my trauma growing up was actually the thing to work with in order for me to build the muscles to know how to have a wiser view on the world. That as long as I was running from the trauma, it was a kind of a heavy sack of crap that I carried around with me my whole life, trying to get away from something that I had to carry with me my whole life. But when I actually turned and started facing it, dealing with it, like, okay, this is here in the room, how can I move beyond it? Then my whole understanding about trauma changed. My whole understanding about the difficulties I had in my childhood, it changed. And I began to see that those difficulties were actually a gift. And I'm hoping today that's what you take away. I'm hoping by the end of the day you begin to see that all the difficulties and all the challenges that we face in our lives are actually the very thing necessary for you to know what right intention is. And that's what today is. It's actually the application of what we talked about yesterday. So the way we're going to do this morning, the same way we did the other two halves, I'll do some talking here for a while and set the framing for what we're going to practice with. Then we'll practice for an hour and a half, have some questions, and then go to lunch. And then in the afternoon, we have probably about an hour and a half, so it won't be the same kind of a structure. It'll probably be less of, it'll be probably one sit period that's not too small, and maybe a walking. We'll frame it for how you take this out in the world, and then some questions, answers, and go home. So this morning is the last piece that we're going to talk about. And it has to do with Buddha's instructions to his son Rahula. When I first heard these instructions to Rahula, I was newer in the practice and didn't really... I mean, I just thought what I'm about to tell you was the stupidest thing anybody could ever tell a kid. Just to be honest and blunt about it up front. Because I'm telling you this up front so you don't turn off before, as you hear what his instructions are, you will hear how complicated it is and your mind will think, no way I can do that. So I'm telling you up front, there's a flip side to this. And it is completely doable, and it is probably the best instructions that any teacher could give a student. So what he tells Rahula, Rahula was 7 years old when he got these instructions. Anybody got kids? Anybody got anybody 7 years old? You know what them 7-year-olds are like. You got to tell them like 9,000. 1,000 times. And I'm sure the Buddha told Rahula this once. I doubt he told him over and over and over. So he tells Rahula, and Rahula was a young novice monk at the time. So Rahula had taken his own robes and was practicing as a monastic. And so the Buddha was giving Rahula his instructions on how to sort of move in the world. And he tells Rahula, he asked Rahula, what is a mirror? And Rahula says, he asked Rahula, what is a mirror for? And Rahula said, it's for looking at your reflection. And so he says, so this is the way I want you to look at your life. This is the way I want you to look at how you look at your conduct and how you are in your life as a mirror, as a reflection. And so he says, and to do that, I want you to repeatedly reflect upon your conduct, whether it is a thought, whether it is a verbal, or whether it is physical. So it doesn't matter if it's mental, physical, or verbal. I want you to reflect upon your conduct repeatedly. And he says, and I want you to reflect like this. Before you think anything, before you do anything, before you say anything, you have to reflect. Is this thing I'm about to do, think, or say harmful? Is it harmful to me? Is it harmful to someone else? Or is it harmful to both of us? If you say, no, it's not harmful, then continue on. Go ahead and say it. Go ahead, think it. Go ahead and do it. But you then need to reflect, is this thing that I'm about to say or do or think, is it unskillful? Will it lead to a painful consequence to me or someone else or for both of us? If I think it is, or do you assess, is it skillful to me, to someone else, or it's going to lead to a pleasant consequence? So you have to go through this three-step before you do anything. And if you decide that it's not harmful, skillful, go ahead. You can do it. And then doing whatever you're thinking, while you're thinking whatever you're thinking, while you're doing whatever you're doing, while you're saying whatever you're saying, you have to continuously reflect in your mind, saying two questions. Is it harmful? Is it skillful? Is it unskillful? And as long as you keep thinking, it's not harmful, it's skillful, keep saying it. And then after you have finished doing whatever you did, you have to look back on whatever you said, whatever you thought, whatever you did, and reflect lastly. Was that harmful? Was it skillful? Was it unskillful? And he said, this is the way you are to be in relationship to anything you think, anything you do, anything you say. So let's just take a moment. Who here thinks they can do that? I could not believe that he would tell a 7-year-old that, because that did not make any sense to me. And for a long time in my practice, it's almost like you're setting the boy up for failure automatically, because there's no way you could, no way I could, before I think anything, I gotta think about, is it harmful, is it skillful? And while I'm thinking it, it just didn't make any sense to me. But as I sort of went through the practice and spent some time with this sutta, there are three words that stood out for me that I realized, this is how you determine right intention. This is how you know, it builds your steadiness on the path and you're sure about it. And it comes from these three words that the Buddha included in this understanding. In fact, I think if we all raised our kids this way, we would not have so much shame in the world. So what he said was, the first word is this word repeatedly, right? So he's telling Rahula to repeatedly reflect upon this. So repeatedly do this, then you know it is not something that you are going to learn and not, you know it's a training. If you have to repeat, if you have permission to repeatedly do something, then you know it's a training. That's what I'm doing. I'm not, it's not kind of like, this is the way you need to be, and that's it. There's a kind of repeatedness to it. The second word is reflect. So it's like you are reflecting upon conduct. He didn't say it as a edict, this is the way you need to be. He said, you repeatedly reflect upon your thoughts, your conduct, your words. There's something about this idea. It's like in our precepts where we don't say, I shall not kill. We undertake the training to refrain from killing. And there's something about the idea in this practice that it's all a training, and we're all undertaking it to come to an understanding of what it takes to not kill. And when you're in the very beginning, you might be more like, well, I'm not going to kill any people. That seems doable. But by the time you get on a retreat, and you've been on a retreat a while, you might find yourself actually moving worms out of the pathway so no one can step on them, even though you might be moving them back to where they came from, and they got to now go all the way across again. But I've seen people move little tiny worms. Anyway, so my point is that there is something very accessible about being in a practice where at its root core, you get to reflect upon what is actually happening here. What are we actually doing? What's actually going on? How are my words really landing for me or someone else? How's it really going here? And there's no judgment to it. And the reason why you know there's no judgment in the Buddha's instructions to Rahula is the third word, which is after. That is a significant word, that word after. Because how many of us think you see what you think is the proper way to be, and we want to be that way first? I can remember when I very first stepped onto the path, and I had this kind of altruistic thought about how I wanted to see myself. I never acted like that, but I always wanted to see myself as acting that way. But in truth, I was still the same angry person that stepped onto the path. It takes a while to go from being an angry, irritable person to someone who's more peaceful and kinder. But I did not sort of know that as time, when I first stepped on. My idea was I should be like the person I thought a true practitioner was. But in truth, this word after actually gives us permission to make as many mistakes as necessary for us to learn after we have done it that, oh, that's not the best thing to do. Oh, I see, I shouldn't probably be that way. This is more harmful. It is a quality in Dhamma that we don't give it, I think, its proper level of respect, which is, as practitioners, you are learning for yourself how to discern what is harmful and what is not, what is skillful and what is not. And oftentimes, you won't learn what that is until after you've made some decision and you said something, you've done something, you thought something, and then you realize upon reflection afterwards that that's not so skillful. To give us as practitioners permission to consider the wisdom of our conduct and our words and our thoughts after we've already done it, and hold that in the same sort of wise place as doing it before you do it, or if I can't do it before, make the wise decision, then at least while I'm doing it, can I catch myself and stop? But most of us end up not realizing it until long after we've done it, and then we look back and say, oh man, I shouldn't have done that. That understanding is as valuable and wise as if you had never made the mistake in the first place. Do you get that? Can you see how what he gave Rahula was actually permission to be himself? Go along the path however you go along it. Do it however you do it. Take whatever chances you want to take. Mess up, don't mess up, whatever. Whatever we do is on the path towards understanding what is the right intention. What is the intention to do? The right intention being the two thoughts that we talked about yesterday afternoon, kindness, non-harm, and this renunciate life. So that is right intention. This intention to be kind or be receptive, soft, and have goodwill, to do no harm, and then have this renunciate life. But he gave Rahula permission, even as a monk, and your father is the head guy, so everybody's looking at you to get it right. He gave that child permission to mess up, as long as that child reflected upon it and began to understand what's the difficulty? Why was this not skillful? Why did it seem skillful when I thought I could do it, and now in reflection, it wasn't so skillful? Or what if I thought this wasn't going to harm anybody, but then after I do it and someone comes back to me and say, that was very harmful, that I have that as understanding. Do you see the difference? Think of somebody coming and telling you, you do something, and they're like, that really hurt me. How could you do that? And we're like, we didn't mean any harm. So our first thing is to be defensive and say, no, I didn't mean any harm. But then upon reflection, you could see, oh, maybe. I learned this with pronouns, mispronouncing people. And at first, when the idea of identifying people's pronouns first came out, I really didn't see the significance of it. People call me, I have a low voice, so when I'm on the phone, people say, Mr. this, Mr. that, all the time. And I'm thinking, it's not a big deal. What's the big deal? But over the years, I have come to respect and understand the pain of the mispronouncing someone who is not male or female. They're not binary. So for me, I know I am female. So if somebody calls me a male, I think that's just their mess. You just don't know. But if I am not male and I am not female, then to call me male or female is a much harsher pain. It's almost as if you're not seeing the non-binary place. But even with all my understanding from all my friends that are gender non-conforming and non-binary, I still will mispronounce people. People that I know are theys, I will still mispronounce their name or who they are. And I still now have to constantly check that all the time. But the sting and the embarrassment that I used to get, so I didn't want anyone ever to tell me I said the wrong thing, they. That sting, I don't know if it's in your community, but in a lot of my communities, people just jump in and tell you. So you say she or he, and they'll say they. And then you'll get it. And there's this automatic kind of, oh yeah, they, I'm sorry. And you say they, and you try to remember. But that process of all the pain that we went through, all the rubbing, all the pushing, all the harm, all the difficulty and the embarrassment, and I hate this, and I'm never going to learn how to do this. All of that after effect is what is the real reason why we mostly understand pronouns now. We mostly understand gender nonconforming. We understand that there are people that are not in these categories of male and female. But we would never have understood that but for the after, the allowing us to learn this after a lot of mispronouncing people. Do you see what I'm pointing to? Much of our understanding around harm comes after the harm has already happened. It doesn't come before. Because before, you are deciding how something should be based on your thinking. Because that's what you think, this is the best thing for me to do. You don't even recognize whether it causes a harm or not. You won't know that until somebody tells you. I'll never forget, I was talking about Sangha. And I was asking Greg Kramer, who does Inside Dialogue, I asked him, I said, you know, like, what's the point of Sangha? I mean, I understand the Sangha is important, but I'm not quite sure I understand why it's so important. And he said, because he's a relational teacher, right? So I'm like, why do you think the Buddha said this is important? In case you don't know what Inside Dialogue is, it's two people meditating together with each other. So the whole point of it is relational. He said, Tawari, how would you know you were arrogant unless someone else told you? How would I know? I would think I'm great! What? I wouldn't have any issue. I would be like, I'm the best! I'm perfect! Everything is right! I would be happy! Somebody else has to tell me that that energy is arrogant, that that energy is rude or harmful to someone else. And that you can only get in the rubbing of Sangha. It can only happen in the rubbing with other people. So most of our knowing what is harmful will not come from your own understanding. There's a moment we got to take here. It does not come from you. You may think you're not being harmful, but that is not the true way to determine harm. I had to learn I was being harmful by the people I actually harmed, which is a very strange way of being in the world. So a couple of things that a couple of people mentioned, like last night, that the word wholesome and unwholesome doesn't really work. So I'm putting this here, saying this here, so that we can, when we start thinking about harm, harm might be too harsh of a word for you. You might feel like, I don't even want to admit that I harm anybody. I don't do anything harmful. I'm like a nice person, good person. I wouldn't harm anyone. And so that word might get complicated. So like the word unwholesome, wholesome gets complicated, and someone mentioned that they use, is it serving? Serving me, is it serving other people? Or someone used helpful, is it helpful, not helpful? So you have to figure out skillful, is it skillful, is it not skillful? He used that word to Rahula, he didn't use, well that's where it's translated. He didn't use the word unwholesome. But the point around harm is another way you could think of harm. Is there tension here? You can think of, use that word, tension. Is there conflict here? is there difficulty here? Discomfort. These are the words you might want to think of. Has my words, my thoughts, my actions created discomfort in the space? You don't have to think of it as, did I harm somebody? But you could think of, we can all kind of feel it. You know, it's pretty easy to tell something's not right. You can, there's a sense. I said something last night with the BIPOC group. I'm not going to repeat it, but I said something last night. And I remember feeling the moment I said it, oh, something off, that didn't quite land right. Something's wrong. We can learn to feel into that discomfort, that sadness. And in that, I've learned to consider there might be harm. That is just the nature of the way we are as humans. We do this with each other, and we are learning not to get still for the purposes of peace. I think we are learning to get still for the purposes of being sensitive to harm. Very sensitive to harm. Like when you go at the end of a retreat, anyone that's done like a week-long retreat, by the end of that retreat, you're almost afraid to go home because it seems so much more painful if I go home now. I feel like I'm so sensitive and soft, I'm too afraid to go home. But you're actually stronger because of that sensitivity to harm. So the stillness that you have in you actually allows you to be more capable of feeling into the harm. This is what I think our task is. You know, Mission Impossible. Your task, should you choose to accept it, is to be willing to get sensitive enough to feel discomfort, to feel suffering, feel it and know it. It doesn't have to be just yours. You can feel discomfort in spaces with other people and know that there's some pain here. And the Brahmaviharas are practice cultivating loving kindness creates the capacity for us to be able to handle that discomfort. We don't have to fix the problems, but we have to be able to feel the discomfort of someone else. And this is what I think right intention we are lining up with. Gradually, slowly, learning how to feel into the pain of another and not feel responsible for it. See, I could not have had this conversation with you yesterday morning. I couldn't have started here because our minds, our ordinary minds, can't hear like this. We can't talk like this. We can't consider pain like this. We have to actually wait until we have stilled, steadied the body, the sense of self, to a samadhi level, and we can hear. So yesterday morning, we were just working on right view, right intention, right view, right intention. And then gradually, we kind of settle in. Everybody's conduct began to move into that direction. You're sitting with everybody, walking with everybody, sitting with everybody, walking with everybody. Everybody's intentions are becoming set towards this, pointed north. And once you get set in that way, we can have a conversation about the idea of how harmful we are, and that conversation, that felt sense, resonates. And we can hear it not as judgment, but as possibility to live a completely different way. I think this is what Buddha was telling Rahula. He was saying take everything that happens on the path, everything that happens in your life as a monastic, it's all good. There's no good things and bad things. And we kind of walk tilted. We only want the good side. We just take that all the time and try to walk our way through. But you got to sort of have both. That's why I think this human birth is so destined for our ability to awaken. All the harm, and well, let me say there was a sutta where the Buddha had his monks were sitting talking, and some other monks from another sect came up to him and said, you know, what's so special about your Buddha? Because, you know, Buddha's monks were known as the happy ones. So they slept on charnel grounds where dead people are. I know it smelled. I can't even envision it in my head, let alone, I can't barely envision camping, let alone sleeping outside with the dead bodies and bugs and things. No! But the Buddha's people, you could go days without eating because you couldn't carry any food with you. You sort of had to hope somebody offered food for you. Didn't have any food. You could be hungry. You slept outside in the weather on charnel grounds, and yet they were happy. They smiled and they had joy. And so people would often want to know what was Buddha teaching? What was he doing? And so the group of monks came to these monks of the Buddha and said, you know, like some of his students, and said, what is this Gotama, what does he teach? You know, our teachers teach about the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening, just like your teacher. We know about them, and so what makes your Gotama so special? And of course the monks, they didn't know what made their teachers so special. So they thought, we don't know. It says, oh, well, that's good. We all know the same. Nothing special. So they go to the Buddha and they asked him. They know he's special. They know he's doing something special, and they don't understand what it is that he teaches that's so special. And he told them, I don't teach you the seven factors of awakening. I mean, that you can know. That is just knowledge, right? I can teach you what the seven factors of awakening are. He says, what I teach is discernment, so that you know when you have a lot of energy, how to apply the calming factors of the seven factors of awakening. Seven factors of awakening has mindfulness, and it has three calming factors and three energizing factors. So I teach how to discern when you have too much energy, how to apply the calming factors. I teach when you have too low of energy, how to discern that you need calm, energizing factors. So that's what I teach. That's what he was teaching Rahula, is discernment. If I kind of told you what right intention was, if I told you do this and it's non-harm, it would kind of make sense, maybe in the context of me saying the words. But it only makes sense to the people who believe what I'm saying, because the people who get harmed, they wouldn't believe it. This is the difficulty with being non-binary. You live in a world where it's all binary, we all think, or if you're straight, you live in a world where everything's heterosexual and you don't think nothing of it. If you're white and you live in a world that's predominantly white, you think, oh, this is the way the culture should be. This is the way we are. And if you happen to be in a different culture, it's a pretty difficult place to be in. But we don't see it that way because we set these rules as if this is the way to be. What the Buddha did was something completely different. He taught discernment for any scenario. So it doesn't matter whether or not you, when you approach any scenario in any moment of time, you can learn how in that scenario, in this present moment, is there tension? If there's no tension, fine, we're good. We could fine along. Is there tension? Oh,
attention? What? Where is that?
Is that mine? Is that someone else's?
You learn to begin to get sensitive to the tension, and you can discern harmful behavior.
So remember when we were talking, I think we were talking about it on Friday night, that, you know, when you get awake, you kind of just, if you look at the Buddha, he could say the right thing to people at the right time. He just seemed to know what people needed to hear. But that comes from discernment in the present moment. It doesn't come from, I'm so smart, I got a laundry list of stuff in the back, and you come in front of me, and I pull out the laundry list, oh, okay, this is what you need. Okay, oh, that's what you need. He didn't do it like that. He would just sit as an empty vessel. You come up, and he could feel the tension in the moment. He could feel where you have some tension, and he could address that. That tension we address. And then you feel smooth because you get the tension unwrinkled, and now you're feeling more ease. Not because he had some big, huge laundry list. He was emptier and emptier and emptier. Less knowledge, 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 stacked all up. Wisdom, 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 stacked up. Less of that. More, I don't know nothing. I don't have nothing, I don't know nothing. But I know tension, and I know discomfort, and I know harm, and I know how to feel it. Not I know it because I think that's harmful, but I know how to feel it. And I'm not afraid of feeling discomfort. Then I can begin to look at it and see what would be helpful right here in this moment for this person with this harm. That's what I think we are ultimately moving towards. It's that kind of an understanding. Do you see what I'm pointing to? So this morning, we are going to practice a little with trying to just be as, it's not, it won't be perfect, it might be a little wonky, but we're going to see if we can just be with whatever we are. However we are, just the present moment, I'm going to try to get the instructions to just get you to be in the present moment, be in the present moment, be in the present moment. And you might begin to notice thoughts. You might begin to notice, remember some of the things you've done in the past, and then consider upon reflection, is that harmful, skillful? Right? And just to reflect upon it. But even if we point towards a thing we did in the past that may have been unskillful, the question is, can you see now, can you feel in this moment where that tension is, where that discomfort is, where that harm is, and not judge either yourself or the other person, and just begin to be sensitive enough to feel a little bit of the tension. That's what we're going to see what we can do. Just to feel a little bit of the discomfort or a little bit of the tension, and see if we can begin to see a little bit more as to whether or not we can discern just by feeling into the present moment. That's what I think we'll begin to look at. All right? And then we'll talk a little bit more about it in the afternoon, more globally, more like on a larger scale, how we can apply this same thing. So let's take, it's a quarter to, let's take 15 minutes to kind of let what I've said, the words settle in, and we'll come back at 10 o'clock, and we'll start our practice period. All right?